This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to an archived edition of The Mark Steiner Show here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. So we're not accepting calls, but please send us your feedback at steinershow@gmail.com. Now back to our segment. We're going to talk to noted historian Thomas Sugrue to discuss his new book, Sweet Land of Liberty, The Forgotten Struggle for Civil Rights in the North. Then Tom Sugrue, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
This book, I think, is important for a number of reasons, but I think that there's this misconception about civil rights and the struggle to end segregation that we never think about the North as part of the struggle, other than thinking that it was when Martin Luther King went there, the housing campaign in Chicago, and civil rights blew up in the North. But that's all we ever talk about in any serious way.
That's right. I mean, we tend to focus on what historians sometimes call the classic phase of the movement, which was between Brown versus Board of Education, the Supreme Court decision that ruled that segregated schools were unequal, or the Montgomery bus boycott in 1955. And it usually goes through the life of the Reverend King and the organizations he was closely associated with, and ends in 1968 with King's assassination. And usually the North is kind of comes on the stage at that point as the spoiler, as the tragic ending of the otherwise triumphant story of the victory against Jim Crow in the South. And I try to push the boundaries back and forth and look at how really central the North was to the history of civil rights in America.
And the way you wrote this book, one of the subtexts is, it seems to me, and actually in the text as well, is that what happened in the North, and you start the 1920s and move us to this era, is that in many ways the struggles that took place in the North were actually an inspiration to the South.
Yes, in many respects, Northern activists provided inspiration and networks and information and served as personal resources for many folks in the Southern freedom struggle. The connections are a lot deeper and more interesting than we've led to believe. So Ella Baker, who becomes one of the leading advisors of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in the South in the 1960s, she gets her start as an activist in Harlem during the Great Depression. Or the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.'s close associate, C.T. Vivian, starts off in the 1940s protesting segregated restaurants in Peoria, Illinois, of all places. And so these people and many others are connections between the freedom struggle in the North and the freedom struggle in the South.
Let's talk about that for a minute. I mean, I think one of the things that's also fascinating for people to learn and understand about our history is that even though there was legal segregation in the South, there was de facto and institutional segregation by policy and employment in other ways that made, in many ways, the North almost as segregated as the South.
That's right. I mean, I found when I was doing research for Sweet Land of Liberty that public accommodations, that is restaurants, hotels, swimming pools, beaches, movie theaters in the North were, for the most part, as segregated as they were in the South. So communities with swimming pools would have special days just for African Americans, and often they would drain the water from the pool before whites and refill the pool before whites could swim. They had separate sections in movie theaters, usually the balcony. And restaurants, many restaurants in the North, up through the 40s and some places the 50s and even the 60s, refused to serve African American customers.
And we did a few months back this show on the sundown towns, which were mostly in the North.
That's right. And these were towns that usually had signs posted outside of them, or at least kind of informal word of mouth that said, and I'll use the polite word, Negro, leave this town before sundown, or, you know, something bad will happen to you. And so African Americans avoided these places because the threat was that their life and well-being would be in jeopardy.
So you. It's interesting how the history of this book, because it really begins in the 1920s, in the great migration from after World War I from the South to the North, with a black migration looking for work and looking for freedom and work, and moving to Chicago and moving to New York and even L.A. and other places. That is where you begin your sojourn.
That's right. The massive movement of African Americans to northern cities in search of jobs, in search of opportunity, in search of liberty, really, was the catalyst for the civil rights movement in the North, and it completely changed the terms of the debate. The big difference between North and South was that African Americans in the North had the right to vote and very quickly turned the ballot box into a battleground for civil rights.
There's some interesting pieces here I want to get to since you just said that and to jump into them. One of the things is that all through this story, and something that we don't like to talk about a great deal in this part of our history when it comes to civil rights, and also something that we want to blame for the failure of civil rights, is the powerful relationship between blacks in the North fighting for human rights and dignity and civil rights and ending the de facto segregation there, and its interaction with unions, socialists, progressive and radical movements that became part and parcel of the struggle in the North.
Well, that's right. I mean, one of the forgotten stories is the importance of allies for blacks in the civil rights movement, and most of them came from various parts of the political left, from the kind of left liberal side of the Democratic Party over to socialists and communists. I mean, they were in many northern places the only whites in the 1930s and 1940s who cared at all about civil rights issues and provided a lot of energy, financial support, and personal support for the civil rights struggle. Trade unions were especially important because by the 1940s, some of the big industrial unions like the auto workers or the meat packers or the steel workers were really the only racially integrated institutions in the United States. And so they became real hotbeds of civil rights activism as a consequence.
So I wonder, as I was reading the book, I really wanted to talk to you about why your analysis of why the North, places like Detroit and Chicago, great union cities where there were these with unions that became were forced to actually be interracial by the very nature of the workplace, also became so racially separate and antagonistic, and where so much racism existed. I mean, Detroit, which you wrote about in another book, and that is your hometown, was is a preeminent example of all that. What's the relationship and the contradiction here between all of that?
Well, in many unions, there was a small group of activists who were really committed to civil rights, but the majority of the rank and file didn't care for it very much. And that was especially true in neighborhoods and housing. You know, many blue-collar workers had their first kind of tenuous hold on home ownership in the 1940s and 1950s, and they feared that if African Americans became their neighbors, that they would lose their value and they would lose their identity in some ways as folks who had made it into the mainstream of middle-class white America. So even though some workplaces were racially diverse, that racial diversity usually ended right outside the factory gate.
And I just, you know, because you also talk about and have talked about that we have to go beyond the kind of feel-good message of let's talk about our racism and get beyond it to the institutional roots of racism in America. But that's why I'm so curious about why you think it didn't take hold, why that movement across racial lines within those working-class movements just never took hold.
Well, I think there are a lot of reasons for it, and certainly in the realm of housing and neighborhoods, one of the big reasons was that there were a lot of institutions that maintained racial segregation. So, for example, you're a blue-collar worker and you want to get a home loan, or you're a veteran of World War II and you want to get a home loan, banks won't give them to you if you want to live in a racially mixed neighborhood, or if the neighborhood is even at risk, as they would have seen it at the time, of becoming a racially mixed neighborhood. In fact, the federal government housing programs, the ones that we still have more or less in place today, up through the 1960s, wouldn't guarantee mortgages or loans in racially mixed neighborhoods. And so that became a really big barrier for creating these kinds of interracial coalitions. No matter what folks individually may have thought, they couldn't practice what they increasingly preached, which was living in an interracial society.
Noted historian Tom Surgu is our guest today, and we're talking about his book, Sweet Land of Liberty, The Forgotten Struggle for Civil Rights in the North. But it is a paradox in a lot of ways. I mean, when you think about then as now, maybe, that the most racially segregated parts of our country are in the North. I mean, that legacy from that still exists.
Well, that is one of the most striking features of race and civil rights in America. Today, the 15 most segregated metropolitan areas in the United States are all north of the Mason-Dixon line, something that would have certainly surprised many pundits looking back at the history of race in America. And in fact, the most racially segregated school districts in the United States are almost all in the North and in the West. And so one of the lessons that my book focuses on is that really changing people's hearts and minds, getting whites to accept in principle the idea of race equality and racial integration, doesn't necessarily translate easily into a change in how people live their everyday lives. And, you know, I think schools in particular are a really good example of that, where we've seen hardly any change at all, and in fact some backsliding over the last 30 or 40 years in terms of racial separation in education in the elementary and secondary levels everywhere in the United States, but especially in the North.
I guess, you know, as I was looking at this, I was thinking about the coalitions that existed in some of the people who really pushed those in that time when the NAACP was still in the North was a racially mixed organization, even in many places run by whites instead of blacks, especially in the beginning. But you have you spend a great deal of time talking about a man who I knew and people had a huge amount of respect for and is really little known in American history, and that's Henry Lee Moon, who edited The Crisis, the magazine of the NAACP, and but you get into his kind of the brilliance of his strategy and understanding about the politics of this and how he fought. So talk a bit about Henry Lee Moon here.
Yeah, Henry Lee Moon was a brilliant political strategist. He was the son of African-American migrants to Cleveland, and they were strivers, and he went to Howard, which at that time was the kind of the pinnacle of elite black education in the United States, and became a journalist. As a journalist, he began to report on African-American life in New York especially, and got tied into the labor movement in the 1940s. And increasingly, he became the prophet of blacks using the power of the ballot box to accomplish the goals of civil rights. And his argument was a powerful one, and it was very influential. And in some ways, it's the backstory to the election of Barack Obama in 2008. And that was African-Americans can be a decisive swing vote in closely contested races. And a lot of northern states that blacks were moving into, Republican and Democratic parties fiercely contested statewide races, and elections were often nail-bitingly close. And so his argument was black voters can use the power of their vote to get elected officials to take demands for laws forbidding discrimination in the workplace or opening up the housing market or providing quality education, that they could use their vote to force white legislatures, especially, to take their demands seriously.
Well, let's talk about some of the specifics here, because I think they're really emblematic and interesting. You talk about Chicago and Mayor Ed Kelly, and that in that period when you're writing also about Henry Lee Moon, that in those pages in your book, and how you go on to talk about how New York, New Jersey, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Illinois became these swing states where the black vote became important. So talk about that and fold our Henry Lee Moon into that, if you would.
Yeah, well, Henry Lee Moon knew that one of the keys to civil rights in the United States was full employment and fair employment. That is, creating jobs for African-Americans and for all Americans, for that matter, but also ensuring that there's no discrimination in the workplace. And black voters in a lot of these key states were able to get mayors, like Mayor Kelly in Chicago, or the mayor of Detroit, the mayor of David Lawrence, the mayor of Pittsburgh, to open up city jobs, municipal employment to African American workers. It was, you could say, the reward for their loyalty at the ballot box. And municipal employment, you know, city employment and government employment became one of the most important openings for blacks in the workplace. And public employment up to today is still one of the most important sectors for African American workers. Basically, you get rid of government employment, you get rid of a large part of the African American middle class in the United States. And Moon realized that. And so when he looked out onto the condition in many of these cities, he said, here's a sign of hope. Black voters are getting white mayors to open up jobs that had formerly been all white to them. And that's a breakthrough, and it's a sign of the ways in which the black vote matters.
But it's interesting, and just I don't want to belabor this part of your book, but it was interesting that the political figures that championed racial equality, like Kelly, lost his leadership of the Chicago political machine. And you talk about Jeffries in your hometown of Detroit and his red baiting and race baiting. I mean, there was a huge conscious opposition to all of this.
That's right. Look, white elected officials in the North all the way through the 1960s had to deal with large white majorities who were skeptical of civil rights. So oftentimes they did things on the sly. And a good example of this actually, and there's a place where Henry Lee Moon had a great influence, was President Harry Truman's bid for the White House in 1948. And Truman reached out to African-American voters. He campaigned in Harlem. He was the first Democratic Party candidate to stump in Harlem, the first sitting president to stump in Harlem. And he did it largely beneath the radar. But he did it precisely because he knew in close swing states the African-American vote could matter. And reaching out and appealing to them while trying at the same time not to be too flashy about it, so he wouldn't alienate white votes, would be the key to his victory.
And the other part of Henry Lee Moon, of course, was when you wrote about him in New Jersey, in that 1947 period when Truman was running to have his own elected term as president of the United States, Henry Lee Moon created this, was almost single-handedly seemed to create the black power base in New Jersey.
That's right. And New Jersey was a place where black political power really yielded dividends. So New Jersey had some of the most racially segregated schools in the entire North. There were many towns, especially in the southern part of New Jersey, where there were Southern-style Jim Crow schools, a little run-down, shabby school building that served the African-Americans in the town, and then usually a nice new one that served the white kids. In some towns, blacks and whites went to the same school, but you know, blacks went to school in the classrooms in the basement. In one New Jersey school, there was a barbed wire fence that separated the playground so that black students played on one side and white students played on the other side. And New Jersey very quickly, as a result of black political power in the 1940s, closed down its racially separate schools and really transformed the state's educational system. And that was not just the result of, or primarily a result of, white people all of a sudden accepting blacks. It was black activists inspired by people like Moon putting pressure on the political system.
When we look at this, I'm going to come back to what we talked about a bit before about the South and the North. And talk a bit about what your study says about the fundamental difference or similarities between the struggles in the North and the South and how they played out now.
Yeah, well, ultimately, the story of the North and the South is, in most respects, minus the vote, a really similar one, where civil rights activists in both regions faced segregated public accommodations, separate and unequal schools, segregation in the workplace, and used a wide range of different tactics, from protest to demonstration to sometimes violence. They went to the courts. But Northern activists in some ways had a more difficult challenge than their Southern counterparts because Jim Crow, racial segregation in the South was often embodied in, you know, really brutal public officials like Bull Connor, the the commissioner of the city of Birmingham, who sicked his police dogs and had them blast fire hoses on African American protesters. The North had its share of stone cold racists, but it was there were seldom is the kind of dramatic figures that you saw in the South, and so that made their challenge a little more difficult. A lot of the Northern protests didn't necessarily make for the dramatic television that the confrontations between nonviolent civil rights protesters and the police made for in Birmingham and Selma and Montgomery and Jackson, Mississippi, the images that we, you know, carry around in our heads about the Black freedom struggle. There were some of those in the North, but for the most part, Northern racism was more deeply entrenched and didn't always have one single vicious, snarling face.
And it also seemed to have a disdain for the slavery and segregation of the South, but that the whole time that this public disdain for that, for what's going on in the South, it was not budging on its own attitude towards African Americans. I mean, you write a lot about the battles to end anti-discrimination ordinances, to create them in the North, and also the battle over open housing. I mean, these are two of the pivotal struggles in the 50s and 60s in the North that were different than the ones going on in the South.
That's right. And in both cases, white resistance was very intense. So, you know, the first African-American to move into an all-white neighborhood in nearly any major northern city faced, at best, cold shoulders, usually some form of vandalism, and often outright violence. And interestingly, most of those incidents weren't covered very extensively by the mainstream white-dominated media. You'd have to go to the African-American papers to find to get a real sense of how extensive that kind of white opposition was. And when northern states and municipalities, even liberal ones like Berkeley, California,
right,
tried to enact an anti-discrimination ordinance, one that forbade discrimination in the sale or rental of housing, white residents rose up and voted against it on the argument that this was the government meddling in what should be left to individual private decision-making.
So talk about your thoughts about the connection between this institutionalized racism in the North and the racist feelings of people in the battle over race and racism. I mean, it's one of those discussions that we don't have because we're always having the discussion about people overcoming their racism on an individual basis. But when you look at it the way you're attempting to look at it in this book, in terms of the institutional basis for it all, it changes it to me. It seems you change the dynamic of the discussion some.
Yeah, I certainly hope so. I mean, you know, white Americans, especially Northerners, beginning in the 1950s and 1960s, began to profess their commitment to colorblindness. We're not racist. And
right,
they often point their fingers at the South and say, they're racists. We're not racist. We're not putting our hoods on at night. We're not engaged in the kind of overt violence against African Americans, and began to profess a rhetoric of colorblindness. And oftentimes that led folks to overlook the ways in which race was part of the everyday life in the North. So, you know, somebody could say, I'm not a racist. And quite honestly, many of them weren't racist, but they could live in communities where not a single black person lived, send their children to school with few, if any, black classmates, and shop in stores and work in workplaces with very few African Americans there. And so the reality in the North was ultimately that race and racial inequality was built right into everyday life in ways that were very often, you know, very difficult for folks to confront head on and to admit. And so the South became a handy foil for Northerners who could wipe their hands clean and said, we have overcome already. It's their problem. It's the problem of the legacy of slavery. It's the problem of the difference between South and North and Southern exceptionalism.
When you write, I mean, it seems to me one of a pivotal piece here that is the question of housing. And you have extensive writing on housing. I mean, you write about the groups that came together and the battles to create open housing. And I mean, this was part of the culture of that moment, the battle for open housing, and both its success and failure kind of have led directly to where we find ourselves with race in America now, I think.
That's right. I mean, religious organizations played a crucial role in trying to open up the housing market and used, you know, sermons, used their publications, started films about racial integration, all as ways of trying to persuade members of their congregations, whether it be Christian or Jewish, that African Americans were just like them, and that if only they accepted blacks, then the barriers of segregation could come down. But one of the real problems that they faced is that many communities that they were trying to open up had zoning laws that prevented the construction of affordable housing. They had restrictions on who could live in a particular place. Until the late 1940s, there were restrictive covenants which basically forbade homeowners from using or selling or renting their property to non-whites. And so all these barriers were in place and couldn't simply fall down because whites accepted in principle the idea of having an African-American neighbor. And the battles to actually help move African-Americans into even kind of open-minded suburban communities, they faced real struggles. So Deerfield, Illinois, a wealthy suburb of Chicago, there's a proposal by civil rights activists and to build a what's going to be a racially integrated, upscale suburban subdivision. And no sooner than do residents find out that blacks are going to be moving there, that the city has a hastily held referendum on the local ballot. They condemn the land that these new developments are going to be built on for parks, and the dream of creating a racially mixed upscale subdivision in one community is dashed on the rocks of white resistance. And that happens in different ways all over the place in the North in the 1960s and even 1970s and 80s.
So talk about how where you think what's missing here in this Northern legacy when we're talking about the 21st century and what we should not forget.
Well, I think the election of Barack Obama is one of the consequences of the Northern freedom struggle. And he came out, after all, of the tradition of black urban politics and community organizing, both of which were important currents in the Northern civil rights struggle. But I'll say this, nearly all the activists that I write about in Sweet Land of Liberty, a few, dissenting radicals perhaps excepted, would have joined the throngs in the streets celebrating the election of our first African-American president. But they would not have said, now we've overcome. Rather, they would say, 25% of African-Americans still live in poverty. We've got to deal with that. Blacks are disproportionately affected by the mortgage and foreclosure crisis. We've got to deal with that. There's still workplace discrimination. We've got to deal with that. Schools are still separate and very unequal, and we have to deal with that. So at once they'd celebrate. On the other hand, they'd say, we have a lot more to do. We've got a long way before we can genuinely say that we've overcome.
Thomas Ragueux, this has been great. I want to thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
The book, Sweet Land of Liberty, The Forgotten Struggle for Civil Rights in the North by Thomas Ragueux, S-U-G-R-U-E, put out by Random House. It's a hugely important book about our history and a part of our history that we need to wrestle with as we look to the future. And again, Thomas Ragueux, thank you so much for being our guest.
Thanks for having me.